Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. I first became familiar with the work of Dana Boyd, seeing her presentation at the Aspen Ideas Festival a few years ago on teens and social media. One of her key points that day was that parents and teens have different ideas about what's public and what's private. Like parents who look in on their kids' Facebook pages, since Facebook exists in the public sphere of social media, then the teenager getting very upset and saying, "You looked at my Facebook? That's private." Dana Boyd is a fellow at the Harvard University Berkman Center for Internet and Society, a research professor at NYU, and a principal researcher for Microsoft Research. And she has a new book called It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. Hi, Dana. Thanks for coming back on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Do you remember that anecdote about failing to agree whether Facebook is a public or private space?
Oh, yeah. And I keep hearing it over and over again.
We had a Pew poll guest recently who talked about teens actually pulling away from Facebook some because of how public it is, that they're getting tired of all the drama. Do you see that as a trend?
Yeah, what I see from teens is that, you know, it's just awkward to hang out with everybody you've ever met simultaneously. And it's plain weird to hang out with your parents when they're hanging out with their best friends. That's just a strange dynamic. So what we're seeing is more of a fragmentation, which is to say that young people aren't necessarily leaving Facebook. It's just that they're treating it as the place where they go to where they need to see everybody. And then when they want to hang out with their closest and dearest, they'll go to Instagram or they'll go to Snapchat or Vine or Tumblr or Twitter or a variety of different messaging apps. And so we're seeing them all over the place as opposed to one destination site.
And I think the settings on Facebook have become more flexible since I saw you give that talk. So they can do things on Facebook with certain circles of friends but not others and things like that, right?
Indeed, but it's actually quite complicated. So, you know, trying to figure out those settings is really difficult. But more importantly, all it takes is for mom to come and look over your shoulder, and no amount of setting will solve that. And so what I saw, you know, over these years is that young people have focused less on trying to restrict access to content, less about trying to use those privacy settings, and more about trying to restrict access to meaning. And the best way in which they do this is that they do a lot of encoding. So they'll talk about, you know, people by using pronouns instead of referencing them by name, so knowing that their friends will recognize who's being discussed. Or they'll use song lyrics to express emotions in ways that can elicit support and feedback from friends without, you know, tipping off people who aren't in the know. And it's that kind of encoding that has shown that young people are finding really sophisticated ways of achieving privacy in spite of the public nature of all of these technologies.
So, listeners, if you're a teenager or a young adult, how are you navigating what's public versus private in social media these days? Have you had this kind of conflict with your parents? How do you navigate social media when you think your parents might be looking in? And parents, do you look in on your kids' Facebook pages under the belief that that's public or that that's your right or that that's your responsibility? Or maybe you think it's not, but you just can't help yourself. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Tell us your stories or ask anything of Dana Boyd, author of It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. 212-433-9692 or post on WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and we'll ask your question from there. Also on the privacy issue, as teens experience it regarding social media, Dana, does that explain sites like Snapchat where the photo you share, and you share it, then disappears after a short time?
Actually, Snapchat is more interesting than that. So on one hand, it started because of this question of making things ephemeral, this feeling that you don't need everything to be persistent. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you want to hide what you're sharing. In fact, that's actually the misunderstanding about it. Young people aren't using it to necessarily deceive or to hide things. They're just saying that this isn't important enough to share. you know, in terms of persistent sharing. But what I think is so phenomenal about Snapchat is the way it invites you to pay attention. So in a world where we're used to seeing these massive streams, right, so something like Instagram where you just see tons and tons of images, people flick on through barely paying attention to any of them. But when they get a snap, they stop because they know that they only have so many seconds to look at that image. And they click and they pay attention. And in a world in which we're, you know, talking about young people not having focus or not paying attention to what's around them, Snapchat actually really invites that attention in a really powerful way. And I think that's changed the whole ecosystem in ways that, you know, I don't think people appreciate the difference there. Because it's not simply about the idea that it's, you know, more private. It's about the idea that it's saying you have to pay attention to me for a small period of time.
Some of the Snapchat conversation that I've heard among adults goes like, yeah, people want to share pictures, but they are wary of things staying on the internet for the rest of their lives, and in particular with a lot of high school kids who are college-focused. They want things off of there before the college application admissions offices start looking in. You think that's a factor, or is that overplayed?
The fact, honestly, I see a lot more of that amongst adults who don't necessarily want these things to stick around to embarrass them later. For teenagers, it's certainly part of it, but it's also this question of, you know, why am I keeping every picture that I've ever taken of everything? You know, and so you see them taking pictures of, you know, even something like, some joke amongst their friends, and they want a picture because it's funny right now, but that picture is just not going to be funny 5 years from now. And so there's this question of, like, why do we need to keep everything? Why is persistence, you know, by default on every major site? And so some people are saying, I don't want it to stick around, but some of them are saying just, it just doesn't matter enough.
Eileen in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello.
I have so much to say, I don't know where to begin, but let me just say on the last point, you're not keeping it. When you put it on the internet, you are sharing it. Facebook is not private at all. It's a publication. It's your own personal publication, but it's like your own personal newspaper. I tell my kids, I mean, of course they have to give me their password. I have to monitor it in the beginning, the same way I wouldn't give them keys to a car without driving lessons. I mean, it's a coming-of-age thing. That's how I feel about it.
Dana?
No, I hear you. I think one of the things to recognize is that we've done a lot in American society that's limited young people's access to just hang out with their friends in everyday environments. You know, and in the last 30 years, we've seen huge transformations. We've seen the rise of curfew laws, the response to latchkey culture that meant that we put young people in very structured activities from morning to night, limited opportunities of them going to commercial spaces, such as malls, which is where I grew up. And so the result of which is there are very few places where young people can get together with all of their friends and just hang out. And for better or worse, the way that they're...
It is a new world. I agree. It is a new world, but that doesn't mean you can ignore it. Like you, like my father ripping the phone off the wall because what is this newfangled thing? We didn't want it in our house.
So, Eileen, did you make sure you had your own child's password at a certain age, and is your child now older and you no longer have their password?
Oh, no, I always have the password because I feel like, why would you share something with 750 people that know you, kind of know you, and their mothers and sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles and not your own mother? It's not your underwear drawer. And this idea that it's your underwear drawer is so wrong.
How old are your kids?
11 and 17.
Right.
And the 11-year-old doesn't have one yet.
And but you would have the same standard of your parental rights for your 17-year-old as for your 11-year-old.
Absolutely. You know, like she said, the Snapchat, that's private, but the Facebook is not private.
Eileen, thank you very much. And let's go right on to another parent of a 17-year-old, Anne in Manhattan. Anne, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Good morning. I'm calling. I have a daughter who's now 17, and when she was in seventh grade, while monitoring her Facebook, I caught her talking about her teacher and what he thought she was doing at that time. And that's pretty mild about as far as the kinds of things you could put on Facebook. But, you know, you're talking about a group of people whose frontal cortex is not fully developed, who don't themselves fully understand consequences. And, you know, as much as I consider myself a civil libertarian, I think you're dealing in a whole new world.
Dana, talk to Anne and about the unfully developed frontal cortex issue, which keeps coming up on the show in terms of how people should treat their 15, 16, 17-year-olds these days. What do you want to say to Anne?
I mean, I think that you're right. Brains are not developed, and they aren't going to be developed for quite some time. But that's actually a good thing. That's actually how we learn. That's how we make sense of things. And I think part of what we need to, or way we need to approach young people is to help them develop these skills. And they're going to get bumps and bruises along the way. That's actually one of the most powerful ways in which we learn. We just want to make certain that the damage that they do in this process is not really significant. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so, a strong believer of having parents be present and be engaged in these in a conversational way. I think the thing that I worry about is that when we do this in a way that just is saying, no, you're not allowed to hang out with your friends, no, you're not allowed to be a part of the social world, we don't give young people the opportunities to learn, to build, their sense of how to work with this. And so it becomes a process of asking hard questions, engaging them, talking through the decision-making process. And in order to do that, trust is so important, and this is one of the reasons why I think it becomes a process over these years rather than a set of discrete acts.
Absolutely, but you're talking about a situation where kids are, this stuff is forever. We were allowed to make our stupid mistakes in private and learn from them by ourselves and not have the world watch and not have it possibly used against us in a context that even I as a parent can't fully comprehend.
Absolutely, and I think we're watching plenty of adults, starting with our politicians, making fools of themselves using these same technologies, even once their brains are theoretically developed. I think that the as a society, we have to grapple with what it means that this material is persistent. And I think that one of the things I'm confident of is that we will continue coming back and saying, hey, let's question why this material from 20 years ago is being used. What is it, how is it appropriate to be using it now? And I think that the difficulty is that there are some young people who are going to be able to live down their mistakes a lot easier than others. And I think that as adults, we have to then question, not just in terms of what records we can find about people from their past, but who they are today. And I think that's a societal challenge that we're going to have to grapple with, whether we're talking about teenagers' material or, adults' material online.
Anne, thank you for your call. And we're talking with Dana Boyd from the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society, NYU, and Microsoft Research about her new book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. You said two things to Anne just there that I wonder if I could get you to elaborate on. One is that the relationship with her teen regarding social media has to be based on trust, and two, that she should be asking her teen hard questions. So what does the trust look like in terms of parental behavior, and what kinds of hard questions do you have in mind?
Sure. I mean, trust is not something that's just magically there or not there. It's just something that you're constantly negotiating as a parent with your child or, frankly, between any two people. And so what happens is that as a teenager comes of age, they trust you as a child, right? That's one of the beautiful dynamics of being a parent, is that they trust you and you are there for them. And then there are moments where they're trying to find their independence. And so there's this tension that emerges, often around the middle school years, definitely into the high school ones, where they're trying to figure out how to balance, their independence and their relationship with you as a parent. And this becomes a process of having to then work out what does trust and what does respect look like in that process. And it really becomes a way of communicating, right? I'm going to give you a certain amount of freedom in return for you being a certain level of responsible. And if you're not responsible, then I'm going to take away some of that freedom, right? And that becomes a process. And I think the reason why I see it as really critical to be worked out in those high school years is that, with my professor hat on, I have to say I'm pretty horrified to watch 18-year-olds show up on campus and not have that level of independence, and then they get themselves into a whole host of new troubles. Because the thing is that it requires a set of transitions, and that transition doesn't magically happen at age 18. And that's where I strongly encourage parents to find ways of negotiating that and to slowly let them have more freedom, even though it's really hard and even though they do make mistakes.
How about those hard questions? What are some of the questions you think parents should be asking their teens?
One of my favorite, interactions that I had was a father-daughter pair, and the father had decided that he wasn't going to try to get onto his daughter's profile, but was hoping that he would be invited. And eventually she did. She invited him, and he was all excited. And he jumps onto her profile, and the first thing he sees is a questionnaire that says, "What drug are you?" Where the answer is cocaine. And he's aghast, right? He's horrified. And he sort of decides to approach his daughter with, as calm as he can, but, needless to say, very upset. And he says, you know, why did you do this? And she's like, oh, Dad, it's just one of those quizzes. And he was like, what do you mean one of those quizzes? And she's like, well, you know, at school, you know, we have all these quizzes, and sometimes we have these, you know, we understand what the answers are going to be. And he's like, well, then why did you come out as cocaine? And he said, well, she said, well, the kids who smoke pot are really, really lame, and the ones who do other drugs are really crazy. But your generation, you did a lot of cocaine, and you seem to come out okay. And he was horrified. He was like, what, huh, no? And so then he was able to then have a really valuable conversation with her, both about this question of drugs and her misunderstanding of drug culture and his experiences with it, but also, more importantly, about how he had perceived what she put up online. And he didn't mandate that she get rid of this quiz, but she totally did, because she never imagined that it would be misinterpreted, right? And it was a mistake, and she was like, oh, I didn't mean to upset you. But what was phenomenal about this interaction is that rather than going and just yelling at her, he was able to start two really critical conversations, and that they were able to continue those conversations when new incidents came up.
Great story. Garth, a high school teacher in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Garth.
Good morning. How are you today?
Okay, thanks.
My point is directly towards what she was talking about with regards to giving kids that freedom. You know, we had lots of freedom. I shudder to think what would be on Facebook if I had a camera phone when I was 15. But my concern is the freedom to have these communications and these relationships with their peers. Don't you think that with Facebook and with Twitter and with texting, that they're not really communicating in the same way or in the same healthy way that we grew up communicating, even if we made mistakes and failed and got those bumps and bruises? We were doing it face to face, where the consequences were, you know, immediate but also short-lived, where now the consequences are seen by 750 followers and they last forever. So isn't that freedom a little bit dangerous?
There is no doubt that there are differences. I think I'll take your differences in two different directions. One is that, you know, the ways in which we communicate when we communicate verbally are different than the ways in which we communicate when we communicate with text or with image. And so we see young people expressing things differently as a result of it. Now, young people would much more prefer to be together face-to-face, but they very rarely have that opportunity in unstructured environments. We don't live in a society where we allow our kids to just get on bikes and be home by dark. But in many ways, I would say that we should be doing a lot more of that. But given
right.
the fact that their only option is to do it, you know, via the computer, what ends up happening is that they develop a sensibility of how to express themselves in this environment. And that plays the whole range of good, bad, and ugly. And so, you know, I say this because, you know, I'm also on the board of a crisis text line, which is where young people can communicate with counselors via text message. And one of the beautiful things is that when young people are hurting, they're much more willing to be, sharing in text than they are necessarily verbally, which is a great opportunity to help them. Now, in terms of, isn't it more dangerous because a lot of this material is recorded? There's a lot of questions about how that is going to be used. I think it's important to realize that we've had some transformations in our society just because we've had records. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but if you think about the last three presidents, we had a president who smoked and didn't inhale, a president who admitted to doing drugs but then said that it was a mistake because he became religious and decided that that was a mistake from his past, and we currently have a president who said, you know what, this was a mistake of youth. For better or worse, some of this material does disappear, even in the highest of environments. The place where I get worried is that marginalized populations are more likely to be marginalized because of the recordings of what they have online than more privileged populations. And so I think that this is going to be really tricky in terms of how we work it out. But there's a lot of this material online, and a lot of it fades. And I have to admit, you know, I am amongst that teen group who has this material online. I grew up online. And I have a lot of dumb stuff from my teenage years, you know, available out there. And one of the things that I've had to do as an adult is to say, you know what, that's from my past. Can we move forward? And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's part of what it means to be in this networked age.
Garth, thank you for your call. And when you talk about the marginalized groups versus the privileged groups, I see that one of the chapters of your book is framed around the question, can social media resolve social divisions? How do you answer that question?
There was a dream that if we all got online, if we were all in the same place, that we would connect and that these, you know, issues of inequality and race, racial differences would disappear. And unfortunately, that's not what I see at all. You know, some of it is a response to the fact that over the last decade, we've focused on stranger danger and talked about anybody who is different than you being dangerous. That has resulted in an automatic dismissal of people from different communities. Some of it is the reinforcing of, you know, existing bigotries and prejudices. And I think it's been really heartbreaking to watch this. So, for example, you know, Twitter, when The Hunger Games was released, ended up being used as a site to talk about what it meant that Rue was a black character. Mm-hmm. People apparently had read the book and didn't realize that that was how the author intended her and were horrified. And there was so much racist language in response to The Hunger Games. It was absolutely heartbreaking to see. And it's this painful reminder that we live in a society that is extraordinarily racist. And that plays out online. And the thing that makes this so significant when we think about social media is that on social media, we are there with the people that we know. We're there with our friends. We're there with our hometown and our community. And that is very much shaped by the historical race and class dynamics of this country. And what this means is that people on social media aren't even aware of a world that is different than theirs because they're just following people that are by and large like them. And this means that our experiences on any of these sites are very different than experiences of other people because they see these sites differently. And I think that, you know, there's this question of how do we use these technologies to try to bridge cultural gaps rather than to reinforce them?
Natalie in Montclair, you're on WNYC with Dana Boyd. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that Facebook, with all of the friends that you have, it's also, you put something on Facebook, and it's not like everyone just comes in and looks at it. So I think that while it's true, everything you're saying about it, it's also, you know, things do go unnoticed. And I know that I have over 800 friends on Facebook, but I don't see everything that every single of the 800 people do. A lot of it goes unnoticed, and I think that's something that's overlooked.
Dana?
No, social media.
Absolutely, and Facebook is probably the most significant of this because, you know, Facebook has a series of algorithms that determine whether or not to show your material to your friends. Even though they're following you, they may not actually get to see everything algorithmically. With something like Twitter, it's hard because there's just so much stuff that you may not see it because if you didn't log in recently, you're not going to look at every past content. But you're right. There's a mistaken understanding that, you know, just because it's available, everybody sees it. And I think this is where it becomes tricky because you're never quite sure who's seen it. You're never quite sure who's even been shown it, let alone paid attention to it. It's also one of the reasons why Snapchat ends up being a different beast in this because you can literally see whether or not somebody opened your Snap. And so this is where it's also really tricky because the past falls deep into the streams on things like, you know, Twitter or Facebook. And so it's figuring out how to negotiate what's in the present and what's in the past. I met a young woman who part of her frustration was that because people weren't always seeing things in the present, that they were seeing things from the past, they would start drama based on the things that were written like a month ago. And so she actually went and constantly deleted old statuses. You know, she wanted to keep the things as present and ephemeral as possible. And so there's different ways in which we see people managing it, because even though there's a lot of this content available, it doesn't mean people always see it, and it doesn't mean that it's always easy to pull up the past.
Natalie, thank you for that question, and please call us again. Mike in Monmouth, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Brian. How you guys doing?
Pretty good. What do you think?
I think I'm 22. I grew up on this stuff. It came out when I was about 15 to 16 or so.
Uh-huh.
And my parents, I never allowed them to look at my Facebook. I didn't allow them to get in my business. But not because it's so much, as one person put it, that it's dirty underwear. But more because when you're at that age, you want your space. And on top of that, I think that everyone's kind of, we're not looking at the idea of privacy. I think the last caller brought up the point that not everyone sees everything. I put everything on block. I delete friends. I believe that Facebook is something that you use, that it trains you to use more complicated things like LinkedIn or things that are more important for social networking at an older age.
When you said you didn't let your parents look at your stuff,
no.
Did you have conflict with them over who got to make that decision?
No, my parents trust me.
Pretty good. Dana, the model family.
I mean, you know, I think a lot of this does get brokered around trust, and it's always this question of, you know, how do you negotiate that within a family? I have to say that a lot of the teenagers that I met who, you know, parents mandated looking at everything, they kept coming back to me and be like, what did I do that was so wrong that my parents didn't trust me? And I thought that was a really sad question because you could see that they felt like they were somehow a failure. And I thought that was, you know, to watch that question is really challenging. So that moment of realizing that you've been trusted is also part of what gives you the confidence to then be responsible. And we need that confidence to be responsible. You know, the flip side of it, it comes back to this question of, you know, passwords and privacy and whatnot. I often encourage parents to do what I talk about as the piggy bank solution, which is, you know, find one of those old school piggy banks, the ones that require that you break it to get into it. And if everyone in the household puts their passwords in it, it then can be used if there's an emergency. Because, of course, there sometimes are emergencies where you need to look. But what makes this even more powerful is it's not just the teenagers who put their passwords in, but also the parents. Because, of course, if a child breaks the piggy bank to get to the parents' account, that also raises a conversation, right?
Yeah.
But that moment of saying that we can do this without necessarily always violating that sense of trust.
Erica in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you? I was calling because I work with a college prep program at the Newark Public Library. And so I work with teenagers, high school students, and I think that I am horrified by the internet. I am, and I have a niece, and it scares me. And it scares me, one of the reasons is because the internet's dirty little secret is there's so much racism on the internet that it is disgusting. And I am afraid for the children that I know to put up YouTube videos or anything. And I've talked to my students, and they're dealing with a level of racism that I didn't deal with. I mean, there were some things that happened to me when I was in college, but they're facing on the internet things that maybe my mom and my grandmother faced, being called the N-word. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, my fiance, I mean, he's not, you know, high school student. He does, you know, YouTube videos, and he does things about music. You would be surprised the amount of racism that's on there. People just trolling, just looking to just say anything. I think children today are desensitized. I think that the internet gives them internet muscles, and they are able to say whatever they want to say, and there's no type of repercussions. And it's playing, I think it's being played out in a lot of things that are going on in society right now. And I'm afraid because it hurts me that these children are having to face racism in such a way. And it scares me and it makes me really sad.
Erica, what do you think needs to be done, given that we can't uninvent the internet at this point?
I mean, the only thing I think, I mean, you can't, you know, I think we need to recognize it. I think that a lot of times I've seen so many documents about internet and YouTube, and so it's great, but I never see anyone addressing the problem of you know, I mean, the President of the United States, when he was doing the Sandy Hook, you know, when he was saying something about Sandy Hook, people were on Twitter calling him the N-word. I mean, that should have been, I mean, this is the President of the United States, and this is 2014. I mean, it's outrageous. I don't know what can be done. The only thing, I mean, I can do is try to build my students up as much as possible so they can have the defense and have that armor so they can deal with it. How do I deal with it? What do I say? Why is this being said? Why do these people hate me? They don't even know me. These are questions that, I mean, you wouldn't think that you would be having to tell children in 2014.
Yeah.
You know, these are questions you talk to, you know, maybe from the 60s, 70s. I mean, racism still exists, but to this degree, and for children, it's so upsetting.
Dana?
Sadly, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that we have normalized meanness and cruelty in our society. We have made meanness and cruelty the basis of our reality television, the basis of our politics in a democratic society, the way in which we have perpetuated this across every medium, whether we're talking television or whether we're talking the internet. And then what we see reflected back at us is, you know, all of that, you know, leveled up even more. And I think that what you point to about the challenge of strengthening young people, I think, is really critical. The one thing that we know works in a society of meanness and cruelty is that we actually have to build resilience and empathy. And resilience and empathy are an ongoing process, and we need young people to develop those skills. Not to say that this is just, not to say that this is right, but that we need them to feel confident, to understand that, you know, it's not about them, that it's about people that are coming with fear, with anxiety, with hatred that is stemming from a place of lack of understanding, a place of disconnection. And it's really sad to me that it's gotten to that point. It's really sad to me that it's here in 2014. But I think the sad thing is also that it's been here the whole time. It just hasn't been as visible to us. And what the internet does is make visible the fact that there are still some major problems in the society, especially with regard to racism and intolerance.
Well, it's complicated, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Dana Boyd from the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society, NYU, where she's a research professor, and she's a principal researcher at Microsoft Research, and now the author of It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens. A lot of questions asked, some answered. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll answer three new questions about New York City politics. Who is this Parks Commissioner who Mayor de Blasio is appointing today? Why is the new mayor reconsidering the old mayor's restaurant grading system? And why is the instantly popular City Bike program struggling financially? Is it threatened with going under? Stay with us.